Hello, everyone.
I am coming to you from our Zendo because we have air conditioning in the Zendo and not out in my little tough shed where I usually am broadcasting from. So I figured why not, now that we have internet access here. So yes, I'll go around and say hello, starting with Bob K., Tyler, Paulette, Mark, Marv, Joketsu, Paul, Drew, Linda R., Joan, Peter, Alice, Paula, Mick, Karen, Gaffel. Is that Jill there? Yes. And Ruth Ann. So, let's see. In terms of announcements, I will be, not that big a deal. Not that big of an announcement, really, but I'm going to go on sabbatical for the month of July, but the regularly scheduled program will still be going. I have people signed up for Zoom hosting and leading classes and giving talks and all that stuff. So I'm kind of hoping that maybe we make a yearly tradition of this, of July being a little lighter. You know, you might feel a little more free to just take vacations, but then come on back and stuff is led by Sangha members. So, and then maybe we'll have to move the Jukai classes so that it's not, because we just had a bunch of Tuesday classes led by Sangha members. So, so anyway, our plan to start in-person meetings in the beginning of August. So after I get back from sabbatical, so probably right at the beginning of August. And you can come in person if you live anywhere nearby and you are fully vaccinated, but we will be streaming everything via Zoom as well. And we'll have a monitor so that those of you who are showing up online will be visible, and maybe a little bit of an interface with people who are here, and we'll just keep developing hopefully a very inclusive program. And heck, there's even going to be people who live relatively nearby who are going to participate online, I'm sure, who just would rather not drive through the rush hour traffic and stuff. So I have to say, it's been the nice thing has been the no commute over the last year. So that will be gearing up in August, and we will have a retreat. I think it's the third week of August. It's on the Zen Center calendar, and that will be, then partly in person if you if you're fully vaccinated, and but we'll also have online option for participation. And Bob.
Yes, while you're on sabbatical, if we need practice or spiritual help, are you still available to schedule a Zoom meeting, or will that not be available?
That is a very good question. So I have an online calendar that usually you can go to the website, and on the very top menu, you can click Dharma interview, and then you can go make an appointment with me. And there's no appointments available in July, but please, I do want people to know that if you, I don't want that to put people off in case of emergency or anything like that. So, you know, really, if you need to talk, I'm happy to talk. And then you would just email me info@brightwayzen.org or through the website and just say that you want to meet, and then we'll set it up that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. And let's see. Yeah, there is the study schedule for Tuesdays is on the website now. So it would be an interesting, I think Mick is leading a couple classes on, do you want to say anything about it?
Yeah. So it's kind of like a twofer here. On Thursdays will be Sandokai, the harmony of difference and sameness. And then the two Tuesdays will be a different poem by the same author. So there's two Tuesdays. I think the first one is next Tuesday, and that's the Grass Hut, Song of the Grass Hut. And so I'm trying to think, the beauty of both of those is there's no like reading you need to do. They're both like very short poems. So you don't have to like have read anything ahead of time or anything like that. And we'll just kind of read it at the beginning and that'll be it. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Thanks. And I think I mentioned Chouteau's Grass Hut in today's podcast. So it all fits together. And then what is the, I know Jinryu is leading a Tuesday on one of the Householder Koan chapters. So stay tuned about that. And I'm afraid I'm missing the other one, but it's on the website. And then come August, I'm planning to use that Householder Koan book for at least the month or so, because it, I think, will spark some really interesting conversations. And there will be, let's see, so Shoketsu will be doing a talk this Sunday on the Dharma of Serving Family. I mean, not, yeah, like, yeah, I guess it's this Sunday, right? It's this coming Sunday, geez. And then Shoketsu's like, ah! And July 11th, we'll have a guest teacher, Ryushin Creedon, from who's in Corvallis, will be joining for a Dharma talk. So I think that's it. Any questions or comments or other things I should announce? So tonight's talk, I was going to do about something from the Householder Koan book, but then I ended up having some conversations with people, and it just made me think that this would be a good topic. So, like, what makes a Buddhist, or is Buddhism really for me? And I don't know how relevant this question is for many of you. For some people, I don't know, you might not really care. or you might think, yeah, I'm a Buddhist, or I don't know, I don't really care about labeling myself that way. But I think it's an intriguing question. I know, and maybe I'm thinking about this in particular because people just took the precepts and formally became Buddhists. And I know for me, that was a big deal. But I also have corresponded with a few people who have gotten involved, particularly with the Sangha over the last year or so, you know, primarily online. And then I don't see them for a while. And then, you know, I just reach out and say, how's it going? And, you know, sometimes people are like, well, you know, I don't know that this is really for me, which is totally, like, totally legit, right? But I wanted to explore that. What does it mean? Is there anything you need to do to belong to the Buddhist club? You know, what are the minimum requirements? What does it mean to be a Buddhist, at least in our tradition? So I thought it might be fun first. So I have some things to say on this, but I thought it might be fun first to go into breakout rooms and have secretaries in each room write down, like, you know, so what makes a Buddhist? And I don't know which of these is going to be the most salient way to put it. So I'm just going to list off a bunch of different ways, and hopefully it won't just be confusing. Because I know that when I go to breakout rooms, sometimes people are like, what? What was the question again? You know, what makes a Buddhist, or what is essential for a Buddhist to do or believe? what do you mean when or if you state I'm a Buddhist? What, you know, what are the basics of what that means to you? And what do you think it means to belong to our, you know, Zen community? What are some of the things you perhaps think you should be doing, but you're not actually doing, or you may or may not be actually doing, or you don't do them all the time, but you kind of feel like you should if you're part of this community? And it may also be helpful to think in terms of what behaviors or characteristics in others do you observe that make you think, oh, they're a good Buddhist. So does that, any questions about what I'm asking before we spend about 10 minutes in breakout rooms? Don't be shy. Feel free to speak up. Like,
Can I just ask one thing that maybe might help people feel a little more comfortable about this? Particularly if you're in a breakout room and you want to say something that maybe you don't want to get shared with the larger group, just let people know. Because I know that sometimes it gets a little weird if I'm like, oh yeah, so-and-so said this in the breakout. Like, I don't want to report back anything that you don't feel comfortable with as a secretary. So.
Well, and also the secretary could report back without mentioning names too. So that's what I felt might make people feel a little less inhibited if they're just the report, secretary is going to report back like, yeah, a Buddhist should meditate all the time or whatever, right? and don't be shy in a way, hopefully. Like, I don't think my whole point, I think, tonight is going to be that there are no set or really fixed or right answers to this. So mostly I want to be just exploring, like, we're all carrying around and ideas about this, whether we mean to or not, about what we think we should be doing or a good Buddhist would do. So just do like 10 minutes and randomly assign people. All right. See you in a few. All right. I hope that was fun. I'm going to share my screen with the little document that we can write on together. It's fun to find out what kind of ideas people had. People over a little bit. Okay. secretary, I think there's four rooms. I don't know. Secretary of room one, I don't know if you know what room you are in, or just go ahead and unmute yourself.
I guess I'll just go first. I was the secretary in my room. So we talked about a couple of things. Actually, we got, okay. So we mostly talked about like, what draws people to Buddhism is the kind of practicality of it, the way it gives you kind of a set of tools to navigate your life, you know, while holding this like regard for all beings and this kind of sense of equanimity. Like, how do you live that in your life? Which I think was a theme running throughout a lot of people in the group. One of the things that I thought was great was Someone said that what behaviors make me think others are good Buddhists, and someone said a good listener, and I really liked that. I hadn't thought of that, and I thought that was really good. And then one of the really interesting and super curious things that we got to right at the end that we didn't really get to kind of prod around a bit was the relationship between Buddhism and having a sitting practice, and are they sort of like necessarily tied together? Because there's nothing necessarily in the precepts, at least, about like sitting and like doing zazen. And so that was a really interesting thing that we kind of just got into, but then the breakout rooms closed.
Cool, thank you.
I'll go next. And I'll follow up with the first thing was, we got to that right at the end too, the point that being a Buddhist is more than meditation. You know, it's about following the precepts. So that was one thing we talked about. Another thing that brought people, and it kind of follows along with the first thing that you wrote, was something. Some people mentioned that they were drawn to Buddhism because when something challenging occurs, it's helpful. It helps them navigate that. It helps them to be present to what's going on rather than run away from it or try to control it or whatever. So that was an important point. And another one was compassion. Compassion is like an essential part of being a Buddhist. In many ways, compassion for yourself, compassion for others. Let's see. We talked about the idea of what is a good Buddhist, and one person expressed that's really not a path of being a Buddhist is to determine what's good and what's bad. So that was kind of, we talked about that a little bit as well. So
thank you. All right, who's next?
I can go. So we had another conversation about different types of Buddhism. So one of our members was talking about how they had a Tibetan experience. So she talked about how it was hierarchical, and it was not democratic at all. So we talked about how Zen seemed, or at least in our practice, it seemed more democratic, or as someone referred to it, as a punk rock Buddhism. When you go, you always go back to your experience. So everyone's experience is valued. So I feel like that's kind of a description of Buddhism in a way, that everyone's experience is valued. And then we got to some of the questions. We went or got to what it means to be a Buddhist. And someone said that the self-attachments is the source of suffering. So your point is to try to release that suffering. And we said that compassion is a guiding light. And then that it's a way to examine your life so you can harmonize it. And that's it. Unless someone wants to add anything else.
I'm gonna just chime in real quick. So I brought up the Tibetan, and I didn't mean to criticize the tradition at all. I just meant to say that the senior members were kind of given more time, airtime, and the teachers. And so when I came into the Zen group, I was surprised to see how much everybody was kind of on the same level playing field. Yeah. it.
Cool. Yeah. So I think there's one more group. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess we didn't ever pick a secretary, so I'll just speak up. And because I wrote some things down. And so is this about everything, or is there going to be more questions later? Or is this just everything that we?
I guess everything that I, yeah. And then.
Because there was one comment about belonging and how there's kind of a reluctance to take that step into organized religion. And then a little bit about what makes a Buddhist should be being helpful in the community or helping in the community. And perhaps, you know, again, somewhat active meditation. And somebody else said, Buddha Sangha Dharma. Yeah, Buddha Sangha Dharma. I thought that was a good summation. I said something about, in my situation, I think of it as an and rather than or, because I belong to a tradition already. And so I'm a Buddhist and a UU, rather than having to decide against that, you know, or to leave the other tradition behind, which is I really appreciate. And then two people did not get even a chance to talk. So if they wanted to add to this list right now, this would be a good time for them to speak up, because we talk too long. So
that's always a good sign.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Let's see. What would I add to this list? I guess I thought sometimes that people might think a certain level of participation in Sangha there's the question of, do you have the sitting practice? But pretty much, if there's a Zen Buddhist, you probably think they must meditate at least a little bit, right? Zazen to some extent, at least. And we have following the precepts, compassion. I guess for me, I also think of equanimity. I don't know. There might also be like feeling thrilled about the teachings. You know, thinking, wow, the Buddha's really great. Yeah. Anything else anybody can think of?
Can I add one that I think is an open question that I don't think I have answered yet?
Yeah.
I think particularly having grown up like in kind of like our culture and our time, I've always associated sort of like religious practice with this, like you have some sort of belief or faith in supernatural. And I still don't know like what that is, or if there's like some necessary part that you like have to believe XYZ, you know, because in most other religious traditions, it's like believing in, you know, this, this, and this are like prerequisites. You got to do that. And then, you know, you could understand all the rest of it. And, you know, this has been particularly interesting for me because I'm not sure if there are a list of prerequisites. I don't know if you want to shed some light on that or not, but
yeah. Before I get to that, Peter, do you want to chime in?
I am a little I want to check in with you about whether one could be silly and equanimous. I just hope one could be both simultaneously, or is it either or?
Well, it sure strikes me that when I'm not feeling equanimity, I can't be silly either. Do you know what I mean? Like when I've lost my equanimity, I'm like, you know, I don't know. I think that kind of humor and lightheartedness might actually be a certain kind of flavor of equanimity, perhaps sometimes in a new way.
I think Buddhists are like known as being a bit silly, aren't they? Like they're supposed to be like joy, like you think of like the Dalai Lama or whatever as an example, but he's always being a little goofy. Like it's just sort of like, I don't know. I feel like that's definitely a thing that Buddhists are seen as silly and happy.
Was there, I think Mark had mentioned something earlier about, I don't know, a lineage or a tradition where at some point for a month, they replace all their Buddha statues with like rocks. So then they like bow to rocks because why not? I don't, it's pretty silly.
I've heard of that being done. I didn't know that. I haven't heard of it being done as like a temporary practice, but.
I saw a documentary a few years ago about another Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist who suffered through the years of the Chinese oppression and jailing and so forth. And, you know, he's an old man and he's like the Dalai Lama, a great teacher. And he'd see a camera and he'd make a face. He was joyous, happy, and goofy. And so I think by those examples, joy is, and goofiness and just being in the moment like that is definitely Buddhist.
Although it's not the only way. I feel like we are, when I see people on the path of practice, generally speaking, people just become more and more themselves. And I've been surprised sometimes. I mean, like one of the teachers that I admire the most is Hogan Bays out at Zen Mountain Monastery. And like, he is not, he's a very, very serious person. but you know, that is just who he is. So I want to talk about maybe, Ruthann, did you want to say something before I go on?
Yes, of course, I'm enjoying the comments, but this is in reference to the earlier question before Peter's, like the question I think was kind of like, basically, what are the shoulds or shouldn'ts, basic of belief that Buddhism may hold. And I know before I investigated at all any kind of Buddhist lineage or sect, I was reading Pema Chodron, greatly admiring her, just how to live in life. And she said, abandon your belief system. In other words, find a comfort zone where you are open to expect the unexpected. And I liked, I'm paraphrasing her, but she does say abandon your belief system. And I think that can be taking any of us out of whatever kind of shoulds or shouldn'ts we picked up from the culture or earlier our formative years. So that appealed to me about any kind of spiritual practice, because I know I would say to people during stress times and people who have stress jobs, you know, it's not easy being a human being. And with these bodies that even sometimes hold the trauma that we might be taking in. So thank you for this good opportunity to ask these questions.
Yeah, thank you. So yeah, I mean, I just came up with a list of some things here that are by definitely not exhaustive. They're just something that I sat down and sketched today. But I was thinking about, okay, so we're going to talk about, are there any, you know, minimum requirements, basic expectations, you know, what you're supposed to believe or do or anything? I figured I'd just start off with the list of like things that don't occur. They are not expectations. And the first one I thought of was, in Zen, we have we have forms and traditions and teachings and texts and practices, and they're all seen as tools or medicine or skillful means, not the thing itself. So like there's the goal of relieving suffering, and then you've got all this stuff that you do, including get together and do what we're doing right now. It's all just a means to an end. So in a way, like, and this isn't necessarily true across the board, but it's definitely true in Zen and in our lineage, is that we don't hold any particular thing particularly sacred. I mean, we hold everything sacred, but you know, if you say one of our ceremonies is dumb, we don't really care. Like, you know, it's not sacrilege, right? Or you say this particular teaching doesn't appeal, or I don't like that practice, or I don't know, it doesn't really matter. I mean, out of respect for others, we don't denigrate teachings or practices, because the person next to you might actually, you know, really, that might be very valuable to them. So we don't say that's stupid, but you know, we can definitely be honest and say that doesn't really work for me, or that I don't know about that. I don't think I understand that yet. So honesty is welcome, as our respectful skepticism and doubt. And for me, that was that was what allowed me really to embrace the Zen path, is I was able to ask any question, and I didn't have to swallow anything or embrace anything. And this kind of follows on that. There are no articles of faith. I mean, I just, you know, I did grow up Catholic. You know, there's the Apostles' Creed. We believe this, we believe that, we believe that, we believe that. And I just, you know, we definitely don't have that. So I'm going to get into a couple things that I do think are the essence of being Buddhist, if you will, but you know, certain list of things you believe in. And like, as Ruth Ann was saying, we actually pride ourselves on letting go of beliefs, right? This is not relying on that. Also, you know, we can think about precepts and compassion and these ideals of behavior, but when we think of like the one extreme is kind of having no aspirations at all, right? You just kind of live randomly, you don't have any vows or intentions and whatever, but the other extreme of that is actually being really caught up in and tied up in your purity and your morality and your how well you keep the precepts and everything like that, and being really caught up in that. So either one is an extreme. So we're attached in either one. So we have aspirations, we have vows, but we also try to hold them lightly. And then, you know, there can be a question of how much time, how much effort, how much involvement do you have to give before, you know, you kind of qualify as a Buddhist, as opposed to just, you know, somebody who's just shopping around? Or, and I, this is where, you know, the temple where I trained, where my teachers formed, which still exists, is Dharma Rain Zen Center. And as some of you know, that name is taken from the Lotus Sutra, from the story about how the Dharma Rain falls equally on all beings and all, like, plants, you know, little plants and big plants, and they all just take up what they need. So in our lineage, it's always been that there's no said program that you need to sign up for. And if you're not part of the club, unless you sign up for that program, right? It's there's many offerings, and people take what they want. They take them when they want, however much they want. And we also talk about people kind of having orbits sometimes. And so they'll come close to the Sangha and then they'll kind of go away from the Sangha. But like a lot of times people just kind of come back. And ideally when people come back to the Sanghas, and this often happens in the fall. So I'm kind of hoping, you know, that July might be a little light, but then August and September will really start to, you know, get serious again. And so people might show up, and people who didn't like the online stuff might show up in person. And really a value that we have in this lineage is that when people show back up again, it's, you know, we embrace them without judgment. I mean, a little human like, hey, what you've been up to is fine, but not an interrogation of like, well, where have you been? You know, so it's very much just like, so as long as you've been away, whatever, come on back. hopefully no awkwardness or judgment. And also, as Katie mentioned, Buddhism is not exclusive. So in every country where it's been a main religion, ancient India, China, Tibet, Southeast Asia, Japan, and the West, it's coexisted with native religious traditions, starting off with the Vedic traditions, which evolved into Hinduism, Confucianism, Taoism, animistic traditions. I mean, that's what a lot of times, if you went to Southeast Asia, you might see people, you know, in a Buddhist temple doing something. You're like, what on earth does that have to do with Buddhism? But sometimes it's just, well, they just kludge together, you know, their native religions along with it. And they don't really, you know, worry about keeping them separate. Definitely in Japan, Shinto. Then, of course, in the West, Christianity and Judaism. And other religions may demand soul allegiance, but Buddhism does not. Buddhism is like, you know, in terms of, it's so truly agnostic, right? When it comes to the supernatural or God or whatever, it's like, it doesn't say God does exist. It doesn't say God doesn't exist. It just says, we're not talking about that right now. You know, if you want to go off and talk about that or, you know, engage in practices like that, that's great. But that's all a list of like things Buddhism isn't or doesn't require. But to some extent, if you go again too far off onto that extreme, then what does it mean? doesn't it require anything of you? you know, doesn't really mean anything. You don't have any beliefs. You don't necessarily have to practice, whatever. And as people said, like when you formally become a Buddhist, you don't even have to promise to meditate. I mean, wouldn't that be like, wouldn't you think like when people formally became Zen Buddhists on Sunday, they would have been like, and okay, and how much are you going to sit Zazen? But then we don't even mention it. Instead, we promise to follow the precepts. So to me, this means that, like as people hinted in that list, right? That part of the essential piece is trying to minimize harm to self and other. That is just a guiding principle to try to be compassionate and relieve suffering and minimize harm for self and other. And the precepts is a way to guide that behavior. But it also requires awareness of our behavior, right? So there's many practices we do that are in the service of basically trying to be aware of our behavior and not be harmful. And I would say, so it's basically listing two things here. So there's, I guess you would say the moral aspect, the compassionate aspect, the non-harming aspect. But the really distinctive Buddhist thing, I think, which is, because there's, you know, many religions and have that general intention. And you don't even have to be religious to have that intention to be kind or beneficial or non-harmful. So I would say the foundational characteristic of a Buddhist mindset is faith that your happiness is largely dependent on the state of your own mind and heart, as opposed to conditions, and that you have the capacity to affect positive change in your mind and heart. So in other words, no matter what happens to you, you could do something to improve your situation, if only through a shift in your own mind and heart and body and behavior. So it's like, to me, it's like the ultimate empowering and optimistic orientation toward life. So I guess I see the rest of Buddhism as skillful means, as, you know, things that we might do, things we can do, things that are meant to be helpful, teachings that are meant to help expand the mind or help us be more aware. And we can embrace all of them or just a few of them, or even, and I think this is what fits for some people, is a largely formless practice. I don't really want to be labeled a Buddhist. Don't really, okay, fine, maybe technically you belong to the Sangha, but you know, like for some people that, you know, embracing all that form and all that formality is not necessarily up their alley, but that intention, that orientation, that sense, like we can do something about our lives and we have the capacity to do it. So I'll leave it there. Questions or comments? Just go ahead and unmute yourself or electronically raise your hand. Or
I have one. I always wondered what your response was, like a one-liner, when someone says, you know, oh, you're a Buddhist, you know, priest, what is that? Or what is Buddhism? Like, what's your, you're at a grocery store or something, I don't know. What's your one-liner?
Your elevator pitch.
Yes.
Yeah.
I actually just what I just said. I said basically, you know, we say that your experience of life is largely determined by the state of your own mind and heart. Because I mean, that was like the Buddha, that was his koan. He looked around and he saw people suffering and dying and getting old, and you know, it isn't all misery, but you know, we all end up facing those things at some point. We face loss, we face death. And he said, basically, are we just doomed to be at the whim of conditions? You know, are we just going to be buffeted about by the winds of fate? Sometimes things are wonderful and we're happy, and then, you know, we lose our fortune and we just be miserable. And that's a very insecure place to be. But basically what he discovered was there's another way to be, which isn't so dependent. I mean, we're still affected by conditions, of course, but it isn't, you know, completely at the mercy of fate.
Thank you.
I have a question.
No, go ahead.
I had a question about the role of study and reading and texts, you know, foundational or particular texts, and what sort of a lay person might do to, you know, make sure they have the right grounding. And maybe this is because I'm a lawyer, so I need to analyze texts in order to think things are real. But, you know.
I think it's a, you know, it's a very individual thing. I don't think textual study is necessary. So if people are just like, ugh, some people have, like, they've taken a really intellectual approach to things and they don't want to do that this time, or I don't know. So I don't think it is, you know, what's most important really is, you know, what I've already mentioned, and I think Zazen. But, you know, I do think it's good to get a basic grounding in basic Buddhist principles, which, you know, on my podcast, I have Buddhist teachings series. So that's like about 10, 15 episodes that are like, all right, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, blah, 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 which are just, they're just such, I think they're just such useful tools, such a helpful way to frame our experience. And they give us a common language for, you know, coming together and practicing. And then beyond just those basics. Again, I think it's optional, and it's something that sometimes, you know, somebody will do for a while and then put it down and then pick it back up. But for me, I find that the study at this point tends to, I've been talking about it like an exercise for my mind, that I can kind of get complacent and just, I know enough, whatever. But I guess I like to say that Buddhist teachings and texts are never about having you accrue more ideas. They're always about prying your grasp off of the ideas you already have. So they're challenging the views and ideas you already have, which is why if you don't study sometimes, you can think, I'm fine, I'm good, I don't need to know anymore. But actually the teachings challenge your assumptions. And in that case, when you're doing that kind of teaching, that kind of study, I think just kind of following your nose, going to the bookstore, looking to the Zen section, picking up this looks interesting, you know, kind of whatever resonates or intrigues or challenges is a fine thing to just move toward. Mark and then Marv.
I was just going to add to the previous question, which was the last time somebody asked me what Buddhists believe, I told them Buddhists believe in reality. Which is a little snide, but at the same time, like, there's that notion that Buddha looked at reality. We can look at reality. It's right here. Right?
Yeah. No, we believe. We believe. No, nothing else is necessary, right? Just look at it.
Yeah.
Marv?
I'm a little nervous about broaching this, but here goes. When you talk about tools, for example, and a lot of what you've been saying, very well analyzed, very conceptual, but it seems like the other half we haven't talked about, the heart, that you can be drawn to the teachings because they move you, and not just because they're useful. And those two things, being drawn and moved continually, I think just for me, that's just as much a part of it.
Inspired and encouraged. I mean, yeah, they can be a source of nourishment for our practice.
Especially if you've been fed many things that you can't believe, and suddenly you're not asked to believe anything, but you're shown things you can't possibly disagree with. And that's a huge release and satisfaction, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm a, you know, in Zen, if anything, actual practice is valued at a higher level than textual study, any kind of understanding in that sense. Like, just putting it into daily life, putting it into practice, sitting. But, I mean, obviously, I really love words. And, you know, I will read stuff, I will hear stuff, and I will feel something shift in me. It's not just an intellectual thing. It can be a moment of healing, a moment of growth. You know, that you read something and you go, so I feel our mind is not separate from our body. it's all one package. So I feel like I need to give my mind food as well. I need to give my mind encouragement, my heart encouragement, as well as just kind of, you know, keep the nose to the grindstone. All right, well, we're at 9 o'clock. I'll say our closing verse. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth, all Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you everyone for being here.
Have a wonderful sabbatical, yeah.
Thank you, Domio. Have a great time.
Thank you, Domio.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Domio. Have a great time off from work.
Your time off.
I agree.
See you in August.
Come back refreshed.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Paula. How are you doing? I'm amazed that you were